Her body was discovered in a nearby wooded area.
She was stabbed 19 times and left for dead,
where two adults have been shot to death.
143 people have been murdered. Hundreds more have been shot.
She had been stabbed to death.
It was the bloodiest thing I think I've ever been to.
Welcome back to another episode of Dark and Deadly. We are your hosts. I'm Haley.
And I'm Gina.
I just wanted to remind everybody before we begin, if you want to hear a certain case, we would love for you to send us some case suggestions. You can either DM us on Instagram at Dark and Deadly Pod or Gmail us at darkanddeadlypod@gmail.com. And then thank you everybody who voted for our next topic episode, which will be next Monday, September 3rd. Our cases will be about killer kids. It was a really, really close one between killer kids and survival tales. I think killer kids won by one vote. So
look at that.
Should be interesting.
I need to start figuring out what case I'm going to do.
Me too. My mom was like, I don't like the idea of killer kids because sometimes your kids scare me. I'm like, me too, but it's fine.
I mean, there's warning signs when kids are kids.
And there's a reason why they're always like really creepy in horror movies.
Right?
Yeah.
Kids are freaky. Children of the Corn. I'm sorry. No.
Yeah.
And what was that other one? Sinister.
I don't know if I saw that one.
Haley, I think it's on Netflix.
Okay. Well, I'm not that watching movie... it tonight.
No, don't do it at night. But that movie, I think, came out when we were in high school. And I remember going and seeing it. And I was genuinely, like, terrified.
Oh, shit.
Like, on the same level as The Conjuring.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Did you see about the case that's coming out of Idaho right now in Pocatello about the funeral home?
Briefly. So tell me more.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, so somebody filed a complaint. Something happened. And this funeral home was getting inspected. And guess what they found?
What?
Bodies. Tons and tons and tons of bodies of people who people thought was buried and like taken care of. This funeral home hadn't actually been like unrefrigerated bodies, I should say. These people are unrefrigerated.
Oh my God.
They're not taken care of. This is like disgusting. So these people, instead of actually like doing the process and like putting them in a casket, embalming them, doing what they're being paid money to do, they didn't. And there's just bodies. And the police haven't given like a total body count. But from what I read, I believe Ada County apparently has sent people up to Pocatello to help like sort through bodies, take care of this. They're trying to like identify the people, but they're not refrigerated. So this is in the decay process. Do you know how bad that place has to smell?
Oh, I can't even imagine. Like, what was their point of this?
I think that they were probably harvesting
organs.
And bones and skin, right? Because why else would you do that?
I don't know, because you put so much at risk with your business. Bodies smell, and especially when you have a ton of them. Because I did, when I say briefly, I like looked, scanned over the article, and somebody was there for a service and said that the smell was absolutely terrible there.
Yep. So
I mean, can you imagine sitting there in a funeral home, smelling dead bodies, and then going home and reading that? I'd be like, oh no.
So apparently, okay, so I'm reading the Idaho News 6 article right now. It's called The Downard Funeral Home is owned by a Pocatello resident, Lance Peck, and his wife. Peck has a history of license violations, which are on the article, and you can look at them there. Additionally, Downard Funeral Home was previously in charge of donating cadavers to Idaho State University for scientific study. This relationship ended last year, though, after the university did not receive donations for a period of time. In the process of ending the relationship, the university discovered some families believed the remains of their loved ones had already been donated. However, the university had no record of ever receiving these bodies. Following an internal audit of all records and dealings with Downard, which indicated multiple causes for concerns, ISU filed formal complaints with the Bannock County Prosecutor's Office, Pocatello Police, and Idaho Division of Occupational Professional Licenses. The audit was launched in the fall of 2020, and complaints were filed this spring.
So they're 100% harvesting.
Right?
There's no other way.
That's so creepy. Oh, and people are like in and out of there with hazmat suits. Those poor families, Haley.
Oh, I would be livid. I would have a lawyer and ready to sue.
There is. I mean, there's going to be some kind of class action lawsuit, and those people will probably never see a dime.
I know, which is so sad.
What is going on?
How can you
live with yourself? Well, good on ISU for following up with it and not just shrugging their shoulders and having it get lost amongst the million other things.
Right. Like, been like, well, it is what it is. But yeah, I'm glad they actually did something about it.
Well, and all it takes is one person saying one thing to the wrong person.
Mm-hmm.
And like, oh, we thought you guys got the body, and then no one following up on it, for that to easily get like slipped past.
Right.
But Pocatello is not a big community.
It's not, no.
Like, why do you think you can get away with it? It's not a big community.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm sure there's not a ton of other options to go through either for funeral homes.
No. And you would imagine that like somebody at ISU probably knows somebody who went through them. And mm-hmm. if they donated their body to ISU, their family member's body, maybe that wouldn't come up in like normal people's conversation. And I'm just twisted. My family donated our Uncle Bobby Joe's cousin's body to ISU for research.
Wouldn't that, how'd it go?
I feel like that would come up, right? Because that's an odd thing.
Yeah, I would, but I'm weird, no. So.
Anyways, it's really sad. We'll keep you guys up to date on it. I feel horrible for those families. That's just it's you're then having to re-grieve for that person, right? When like the end of their life should have ended in like a graceful manner and with dignity. Well, and now it's not.
And it's not like they're gonna be able. Yeah. Well, and it's not like they're going to be able to like redo the process of burying their loved ones. Now they're part of an investigation. They're probably going to have to go and look through and see if there was bodily harm or harvesting going on.
Right.
And their bodies are already so decayed. You're not going to be able to do an open casket. You're not going to be able to probably have their remains intact. I mean, like when your body starts to decompose, you fall apart. So
why weren't they taking care of the bodies if that's what they're doing?
Yeah, that's what I don't understand. Like, if they're harvesting them, if they just got what they needed and then just threw them out like friggin' trash, I don't know. Which is even more disgusting. Okay, so my case this week is going to be about the murders of Sherry Garrett and Gavin Coleman. And there wasn't a lot I could find about Sherry's early life before she met her husband, Chris Coleman, which is kind of sad. But what we do know is that Sherry was an MP in the U.S. Air Force. And while she was at a canine training seminar, she met her future husband, Chris Coleman. And Sherry and Chris had that like love at first sight moment. They really hit it off. And just 3 months after they started dating, they got married. One of the reasons. Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of quick, but it's military. So I feel like that's also not quick for the military.
Well, that and one of the reasons they had to get married so quickly is because they learned that they were expecting their first child.
Oh, and yep.
Yeah, that'll do it.
It along.
And Chris grew up like in a very Christian family. So like children out of wedlock was not.
Yeah.
Yeah. Both of his parents maybe still are co-pastors at Grace Church in Chester, Illinois. So they rushed to get married. Chris grew up with his pastor parents and had a pretty normal life growing up. I think he had two other brothers, and His parents boasted about how good of a boy he was when he was younger. He was involved in their church and activities. He was a good student and a great athlete. And then they were like super proud of him when he decided to join the Marine Corps right out of high school. When Chris introduced Sherry to his parents, they weren't exactly impressed. In an interview with Crime Watch Daily, Connie, which is his mother, was asked what she thought of Chris bringing home a girl. And she said, "I wasn't surprised. She was just a blonde-headed girl to me." Which obviously, as we know, Sherry is now deceased. And I just find that super disrespectful to say, even if that were like, if those were her first thoughts, you know?
Ouch. That is an ouch.
And then later on in the interview, she refers to her daughter-in-law and her grandsons as three people who were murdered. Just three people who were murdered.
What?
Yeah.
And she's a pastor?
Yes. Both of his parents are pastors. They are not nice people. Which we'll see that even more. Pastors
do harm.
Yeah. It's scary to think that people like look up to these two people because they are not... I don't think they're very godlike at all.
Ugh, gross.
So soon after they get married, Sherry and Chris welcomed Garrett into the world. And then within 2 years, they had their second son, Gavin, which are super cute names, by the way. From the outside looking in, they seem to be like the perfect family. Sherry was a stay-at-home mom, and Garrett was the quieter one between the two siblings, whereas Gavin was more of like the little firecracker. And Chris had a job as a bodyguard for a televangelist, Joyce Meyer. And Joyce Meyer was a family friend of the Colemans. So she knew Chris from when he was like a little boy. So this job was pretty much handed over to him, you know?
Right.
He traveled with her all over the world. And because he was in charge of her security, he made a pretty good salary of about $100,000 a year, which is pretty a decent amount for being 2009.
I feel like that's a really good amount. I don't know what security guards are paid per se, but that feels like a really good amount for a Christian, like daily verse pastor.
Right. I think it's a pretty good amount.
Yep.
And then as with any celebrity or high profile person, such as Joyce Meyer, she would receive all sorts of like hate mail and death threats from people who disagreed with her. Like, it's gonna happen. Chris was actually the one who handled all of these situations, but like, apparently according to Chris, she wasn't the only one who received threatening letters from people. He too received intimidating letters and emails from a certain someone. Okay, for example, in one of the emails it read, "Tell Joyce to stop preaching the bullshit or Chris's family will die. I will kill them all as they sleep."
What?
Yeah. So police found it unusual when Chris brought this to their attention, because it's not often that the bodyguard would receive these kinds of messages, but regardless, they took the threats seriously, which is good.
Well, that's good they did. But I also think that it's bizarre that the bodyguard, unless he was got like physical with somebody, but I feel like that's weird.
Yeah, right? It's weird. Like, normally they would go after the main person. So at one point, one of the letters was actually even hand-delivered to their mailbox. It was not mailed. Someone went up and physically put it in their mailbox, which really frightened Sherry, because that means that this person was in front of their house, knew where they lived, and the letter was delivered when Chris was out of town in Hawaii with Joyce.
Okay, I'm sorry, but at what point why would you not quit?
We'll get into it.
Okay.
So when the emails and letters started appearing, their neighbor across the street offered to put in a security camera in their house, pointed towards their mailbox to catch anything. So the security camera was in the neighbor's house in their son's bedroom and pointed out the window towards their mailbox.
And wow.
Yeah.
That's a
super nice. Their neighbor also happened to be a detective. So,
okay. Makes sense.
Yeah. So his name was Detective Barlow, and he was made aware of the threats from another officer that knew about it. And so the neighbors really, the Colemans and the Barlows didn't really interact much before that. But once they were more aware of what was going on, they kind of spoke a little bit more after that. So
I mean, that makes sense. That checks out.
Yeah. So on May 5th, 2009, Barlow gets a call from Chris, and Chris tells him that he was at the gym and was trying to get a hold of his wife, but she wasn't answering, and asks him if he can run over and check on them. He tells Barlow that he's like 5 minutes away from the house and he would be there pretty soon. So Barlow agrees and calls his dispatcher to send someone else over there with him, and, you know, grabs his belt and his gun and all that and heads over to their house. And by the time he gets over there, his assisting officer pulls in. So nobody answers the door when they like knock on the door, ring the doorbell. And so his partner, whose last name is Don John, not that it really matters, but he goes around to the back to discover an open window with the screen out of it that goes into the basement. And it doesn't look like it's a forced entry. Like, they don't see the screen anywhere. It doesn't look like somebody like forced their way into the back window. And so they thought it was kind of odd. Like, this guy's getting freaking email threats. Why would he be leaving windows open, windows unlocked? Kind of sketchy. So right. they radio in for more backup. And then the two officers proceed to climb in through the window with their weapons drawn to clear the house. And when they get to the top of the stairs from the basement to the first floor, they see red spray painted words across the walls. And they read, "Punished, I am always watching, and you have paid."
What?
Yeah, isn't that ominous?
That's creepy as hell.
13 minutes later, which he said he was going to be there in five, but 13 minutes later, Chris arrives at the home. At the same time, one of the other backup officers is arriving. So that officer tells Chris, "Wait outside while I go in and assist the other officers." And so the three other officers head up to the second story together. And in the bedrooms, they find Sherry, Garrett, and Gavin all strangled to death in their own beds.
Oh, poor babies.
Immediately, like with most other cases where a wife and her, like the children are murdered, the husband is the first person that they investigate. And this case was no different. Like, even with the threats and everything that they knew about, like, obviously they were still going to take that into consideration. But the first place that most people look to is the spouse. So before going outside to tell Chris of the situation, they agree not to say too much to him, including that the manner that they were murdered, unless Chris asked, which he never did.
He never asked how it was done?
He never asked what happened to them.
Okay, well, he's now prime suspect in my head.
Right. So they head outside and inform him that his wife and children are not alive. He breaks down in his driveway, and the first person he calls is his dad. And his father, whose name is Ron, arrives soon after. And then soon after Ron gets there, Joyce Meyer shows up. I don't know why she needed to be there, but she came. And then,
what?
Kind of weird, right? So the police chaplain, his name is Reverend Jonathan Peters. I'm just going to refer to him as Reverend because he's literally brought up once, and then we can just move on. So,
okay.
There's so many names being thrown out there. So he's just going to go by Reverend. The chief of police asked the Reverend to ride with Chris in the ambulance. And I'm assuming Chris was riding the ambulance to go to the hospital to get like assessed for shock and that kind of stuff before they took him down to the station. I don't really know mm-hmm. what the protocol is for that after your family is, you know, murdered, but I am assuming that's why.
Right.
So while in the ambulance, the Reverend looks down at Chris's arms and sees red scratches down his right arm. And he even asks him how they got there. And Chris looks down at them and starts banging his fists on the gurney. Okay.
What?
Yeah. So after he's checked out and everything, he arrives at the Columbia Police Department for questioning. And when he gets there, he seems kind of dazed and shocked, but he's cooperative. And the officers ask him to replay the morning for them. And he tells them he woke up at 5:30 that morning. He got ready and headed for the gym. And he claims that as he was driving to the gym, he called to wake Sherry up and, quote, get her going for the day, which I think is rude, but whatever. And I'm like, okay, you could have like, I don't know, like tapped her shoulder on the way out, but that's fine. But she didn't answer the phone. And so he proceeded to the gym and called her again on his way home after his workout. And when she didn't answer again, that's when he called Detective Barlow to go and check on them. And so they ask about the day before, how was the day before, if there was any fighting or anything that went on. And he tells them it was a pretty normal day. They went out to the snow cone stand and they played catch with his kids and they ate dinner together. And after putting the kids to bed, they watched TV and Sherry fell asleep in his arms. And then Barlow asks how he got the scratches on his arms, to which he tells them it's from the gurney in the ambulance.
No, liar.
At some point in the conversation, a family friend by the name of Tara Lintz is brought up. Now, during the investigation, the officers would step in and out of the room, and they did this as like unsuspiciously as possible. They made it seem like, I'm going to go get a cup of coffee or some water or whatever. But what they would do is they would go out and get information from like the outside officers that were currently working on the case and like on the scene. And when Tara Lintz's name,
they're smart.
Snaky. When Tara Lintz's name was brought up, it carried in a lot more baggage to the case than they were expecting. So they sent another officer who was in Florida to go interview Tara because that's where she was living at the time. Tara was actually Sherry's best friend in high school. So the women were really similar in looks. They were similar in personality back when they were friends. When Sherry became a mom, her whole life kind of changed. That's usually how it goes. She's not a party animal anymore. She's not as crazy. Like her main focus is to be a mom. So,
right.
Totally normal.
So wait, I have a question and maybe you've answered it and I'm just being blonde. Is he under arrest right now?
No, he's just questioned. He's just being questioned, seeing what their day was like to get any information of what could have happened.
Okay.
So, he's their prime suspect, but they're not really making it seem like that to him. They're just saying, well, what did you do this morning? What time did you leave? Like they were alive when you left, right? So that kind of stuff.
Mm, gotcha.
So apparently Chris has a type because an affair comes to surface, and Chris denies an actual affair when they ask him about it, but admits that maybe their phone flirtation was like a little more than just friendly.
So oh God.
The officer was like, well, are you doing stuff that Sherry would like not approve of? And he's like, well, I guess our phone conversation was probably not that great.
Idiot.
The truth of the matter, though, according to Tara, is that Tara traveled a lot with Chris when he was taking work trips. She even joined him while he went to Hawaii with Joyce. So she was there with him as Sherry was getting these terrifying letters, having a good old time. They wore promise rings while they were together. They talked about marrying in January 2010, which is less than a year from when they were murdered. They even had a name picked out for their future daughter, which was Zoe Lynn. Chris,
are you kidding me?
Nope. Chris wrote down Tara's favorite things on his phone, her favorite flowers, her favorite scents, the types of rings that she liked, her bra and her panty size, even her dog's birthday.
So, it's seeming like he's Chris Watts before Chris Watts.
Yes. So I was going to bring that up too, is the parallels between this case and the Chris Watts case is insane.
Two kids close in age.
Mm-hmm.
Except for a pregnancy.
Right.
What's the difference?
Well, that and like, I will never cover the Chris Watts case because I think he's a piece of crap and he just loves the attention. So I will never give it to him. But the difference between the cases is Chris Watts like went out of his way to dispose of the bodies and like try and hide it a lot differently than Chris Coleman did.
Do you think Chris Watts studied Chris Coleman's technique and said, I can improve upon that?
I would not doubt it. I think that Chris Watts is super arrogant. And I think that he maybe saw this case and was like, I know how to get away with it. Unlike he did. Spoiler alert. Gross. Chris Coleman did it while Chris Coleman was charged with it. I think everybody knew where that was guessing. Going.
Yeah.
So you're probably wondering, if Chris was so unhappy in his marriage, why not leave Sherry? Well, Not only was divorce frowned upon in the religion, but it was rumored that any of Joyce's employees who got divorced would be let go from their position.
But I'm sorry. God gives like one reason to get divorced. It's infidelity.
Okay. So Joyce speaks out about it, and she said, I have employees that are divorced, and the downfall of his career would have been the affair, not him getting a divorce. Yeah.
Like, what are you doing? That's a sin.
So Tara had even scheduled their wedding date. She had written down future vacations they were going to take. They had credit cards together. And this asshole has the audacity to say, I didn't think it was an affair. An affair is when you're, he told the officers, an affair is when you're living together with the intent of marrying while you're still married. Yet they had promise rings. They had videos and photos of their sexual relationship.
And oh my God.
Then Chris Coleman's dad, Ron, the pastor, has the audacity to say that it was Sherry's fault that he strayed. Yeah. He didn't hold his son accountable at all for his unchristian like behavior. He blamed that Sherry.
Disgusting.
He blamed Sherry for not being a good enough wife. And if she would have been a better wife, none of this would have happened.
Are they still pastors?
Yes. Isn't that scary?
Their church attendance has to be low, right?
I would hope so. Unless they're just super manipulative and have conned people into believing their act. I don't know.
Gross. But it's gross.
It is. And when you watch the interviews they're in, like they did not care about Sherry whatsoever, which is just so sad. So there are explicit videos of Tara that Chris took when they were on a work trip together, of her naked in the bathroom. They exchanged multiple nude photos back and forth. I mean, they were having a straight up affair together, obviously. And something else that's super disturbing is the authorities found an explicit photo of Tara on Ron's computer, the pastor, that she didn't know about, that she didn't know he had that.
The dad?
Yes.
Oh, so he's cheating too.
Yeah.
And blame his wife's a bitch.
Right. I don't know. I just think it's funny to me that these people deny that kind of stuff. Like, there's proof of it out there. The authorities are going to find it. Why lie? Because now you look really bad.
Although, and I just want to say something. As much of a jerk Chris is, shame on Tara. She obviously knew he was married with kids. I will never understand you should be mad at him. And I'm like, no, she also willingly went in and broke a marriage. He's to blame. He's the main one. He broke the vows. But she also knowingly having done this bears some of the blame as well and the anger. Sorry. I hate that scapegoating stuff.
I agree. And they were best friends in high school. Like, how dare you?
Yep. It's just shitty behavior. You're not a good person either. And just because he's the one with the marriage doesn't excuse what you did.
Right. And then just another little side example of how horrible Chris is. So there's a woman by the name of Vanessa, I think it's Rigorex. She's a neighbor and a really close friend of Sherry's. And they live just down the street. They would like come over for barbecues. The Garrett and Gavin would like go over and play at her house with her kids. And in mid-May, Vanessa sees Chris carrying out some boxes out of the house. And Vanessa and her kids had actually gone over there and set up a memorial in the front of their yard with like Mother's Day balloons and like signed footballs and some Legos, because Garrett and Gavin like loved Legos. So they set out this nice memorial for Sherry and the boys, and Vanessa witnesses Chris pick up the entire memorial and throw it in the trash. This isn't even like a month after the murders.
So what screams I did it more than throwing away the memorial to your dead wife and kids?
Right? It's awful. So let's talk a little bit about their marriage really quick. Kind of get down to the nitty-gritty. Chris was known to kind of have an authoritative parenting style with the kids. He expected a lot out of them. He expected them to be obedient. He didn't like to be embarrassed in public by his family. He wasn't like a super doting father that hugged or kissed the kids, but he did coach their sports teams and was super encouraging to them in that way. He went to every practice, went to every game, was super well that he could, other than his traveling, but he would really hype them up for their games and everything, which is good. Sherry was more of the relaxed parent though. She had a more animated and playful personality with the kids and let the boys be boys. And I think in general, Chris expected his kids and his wife to portray this perfect family American dream type of picture. And like the house always had to be clean. The boys had to be well-behaved and do whatever their dad said. Money.
I feel like this is partly also how he was raised too.
Oh, 100%. Definitely. Money was also an area that brought them a lot of stress. Even though Chris made a lot of money, he said that Sherry liked to spend it. She liked to go to the mall and buy things for the homeless, which is not a bad thing. She'd literally go and buy like food and blankets and stuff like that and go and hand them out. She'd also go on mission trips. And so Chris complained to a lot of his friends Aww. And the neighbors. I know. And he complained to his friends and his neighbors about her spending money because he was working 80 to 90 hour weeks sometimes and driving around a crappy car and missing out on time with his kids, even though he won't ever see them again in his life. And they had a lot of credit card debt, and it caused a lot of tension in their marriage. So much so that he was considering a divorce, but he didn't because he didn't want to lose his job. Even though he told her he wasn't happy and didn't want to be with her, but I'm not going to divorce her because I don't want to lose my job. And then the other reason their marriage was suffering was the lack of affection. Okay. This part is disgusting to me. Chris, like I said, was not a very lovey-dovey guy to his kids or to Sherry. And Sherry once told a friend that one night they had sex, which was super rare at that point in their marriage. And he told her, "Don't think that this means I love you." And then proceeded to tell her to shut up, turned her over, had sex with her, and went to sleep.
Excuse me?
Yeah. And Sherry let it happen because she was just happy to get like any sort of physical connection with this man that she just loved to death, which is just so sad.
I've been there, Haley, and I'm such an affectionate person.
Yeah.
But in my last relationship, nothing. He would like slap my hand away. I'd have to beg for him to like hold me or be affectionate at all or like kiss me. That's not fun. That makes you feel, I don't know, and maybe it's just me, but like as a woman, I felt so unwomanly in those moments.
Yeah.
That I couldn't get him to give me any sort of affection. It's sad and it's like depressing, especially if you like affection.
Yeah, your brother's the same way as you are. And I'm like, not that way.
Well, I mean, our parents.
I know. And I say that all the time. I'm like, I wasn't raised around like super affectionate, like PDA. So you have to understand that we grew up in two different families because your parents are like, you can just tell constantly. It doesn't even matter if they're in the same room, how much they love each other.
Yeah, they're pretty great. Like for reference, my parents still to this day cuddle on the couch every night and my dad rubs my mom's feet. He sits by her desk when she's working so he can be near her. She's constantly like getting him things and hugging him and kissing him. Like, so I grew up in a very affectionate household. Not like gross, but my parents love each other.
Right. Yeah. Like it wasn't too much, it's a healthy thing to see though, as kids like that. I mean, you don't want to grow up not seeing that kind of thing because it does make for unhealthy relationships and how you view affection.
Right.
So Joyce Meyer kind of knew that the marriage was on the rocks. And so she suggested marriage counseling, which they both willingly agreed to. And Sherry knew kind of at this point that he was having an affair. I believe this was in December. So just a few months before her murder. So she had her assumptions about who it was, and she was willing to do anything in order to stay married to Chris. Like, she loved him still. And I think that he really resented her because they got married so early, but it takes two to fucking tango, man. Like, you
were part of it.
Yeah. You're also the reason why she got pregnant. You asked her to marry her. That was choices that you made. So you can't be resentful for that. And she's trying to make this marriage work and you're not trying.
Well, 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 if it isn't the consequences of my own actions.
Exactly. How the turntables have turned. Okay. So after months of counseling, things seemed to be getting better. Sherry was more of her happy self again. They were going to church together. And then the Sunday before the murders, they even received a blessing, a marriage blessing at church that day.
Are you kidding me?
No, isn't that sad?
This poor woman was like, we're on the up and up. And this asshole's planning her murder.
Isn't that so sad?
I hate people sometimes.
I know. Well, like, obviously things weren't getting better with Chris because Tara was still in the picture. And
wasn't the woman in Chris Watts's case named Tara too?
I don't know if it is, that's too much for me.
Hold on, I'm going to Google this. I feel like it was.
On May 5th, 2009, when the officers went to check on in his family at the request of Chris, here's what they found, because I didn't really go into detail of what they had found. So here it is. They found Sherry nude on her bed, face down. Her body was gray, except for like the front of her where she was purple because all of the blood pooling after her heart stopped because, you know, science and gravity. That's the word I was looking for. So her head was hanging off the bed and rigor mortis had already set in. Like when they tried to move her, her leg was bent and it stayed bent. And that just freaks me out. There were two red marks on her neck caused by the ligature. There was evidence that she tried to fight back, which obviously because he had scratch marks on his arms. She also had a black eye that could have either been caused pre or post-mortem, but experts believe it was more than likely caused before her death. But here's the thing. So these experts are saying, why would somebody punch somebody after they're dead? But also, why would you throw a memorial away? And my thought process is it could go either way. He could have punched her in the face to try to subdue her because she was trying to fight back. Or he could have murdered her and then punched her because he was so freaking mad at her for everything and just wanted to get one more good hit in, you know?
So yeah, he's gross.
Could have easily gone either way.
Yep. You could argue it both ways at this point. All we know is that he's gross.
Yeah.
I need to get a different adjective, but.
Repulsive.
Yep. There you go.
Both Garrett and Gavin were also gray, but they showed no signs of struggle. And one of the officers was saying, like, Sherry fought back probably because, hello, her husband is in there trying to murder her. The boys either were like fast asleep, didn't see it coming, or they woke up, saw their dad, didn't think they were in danger, and didn't struggle because it's their father.
Those poor cops having to find those bodies, Haley.
I know. I can't.
I feel like it's one thing when it's an adult, but a child strangulated.
Yeah. And so Garrett was partially covered by his blanket. And there were strands of long, dark hair belonging to Sherry in Gavin's armpit, which meant that Chris killed his wife first. And then some of her hair was probably left on the ligature, which I could not find what was actually used for the ligature, whether it was like a phone cord or a rope or whatever it may be. I don't think they ever found the murder weapon. But this piece of hair from the ligature fell off onto Gavin while he was being strangled. I don't know why that gets to me, that his mother's hair is on him, but that bothers me.
Yep.
And then the words, fuck you, were spray painted across the side of his mattress.
Are you fucking kidding me?
No. Like, it was on his blanket. Some of the spray paint was on his body. It's just sickening.
So he came back through to try to make it look like it wasn't him.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And the forensic pathologist estimated that their time of death was around 3 a.m. And he said that with absolute confidence. There was no way for the family to have been killed after Chris left the house that morning. And Chris didn't even call Sherry's family until 2 days after she was murdered. Yeah.
Are you kidding me?
Nope.
Haley.
Isn't that devastating? He probably called them up and was like, oh, by the way, your daughter's funeral is on Saturday.
Oh my God.
I wouldn't even be surprised if they didn't find out on the news and call.
He's making this easy.
Oh yeah. And then so more evidence that this was him is that the spray painted words and sayings on the wall, on the bed, the investigators were able to find evidence of a receipt from a hardware store dated February 9th, where Chris bought a can of Rust-Oleum red apple spray.
Huh, weird. What color was spray painted? Red.
Red. Yeah. And his dad was like, oh no, he bought that to do targets for the boys for their Nerf guns. I'm like, he probably did. And then he also used the same spray paint to spray paint over his child.
Do you know who I honestly think could do a better job of covering their tracks than him?
Who?
Viv.
Probably, honestly.
Girl smart. And that's ridiculous. Like, you're handing the case to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he didn't try.
This has to be the easiest case that I've ever tried to solve, because it's all there. You were having an affair. You thought you would lose your job if you divorced your wife. You're in marriage counseling. Your marriage was unhappy. You bought red spray paint, and it was red spray paint all over your house, disparaging your family.
And it's premeditated because, oh, wait, let me just, I didn't say anything. Nope. Okay. Some of the words that were, it's at the end of this paragraph, I promise. Some of the words that were spray painted on the wall were spelled wrong and spelled the same exact way that Chris would spell them. Handwriting experts even determined that the handwriting on the walls matched the handwriting Chris gave to officers. Because when he went in for that initial like questioning, they're like, hey, can you please write down some words? Because we have to match the handwriting on the wall to see if it's you. And
I wonder what this guy's IQ is. Do you think it's low?
I don't know. Did you ever find out if Chris Watts's mistress was there?
Yeah, her name's Nicole.
Not even close. Okay.
Nope.
And on the morning that he left the house for the gym, nobody can be seen on Barlow's security camera, which, hello, that's still there. Nobody could be seen coming and going from the house other than Chris himself. And then the real kicker, the threatening emails. Yeah, they were found to be sent from Chris's work computer and IP address. This dumbass wrote his own death threats. Premeditated.
You figured that much. I was wondering. I was like, that sounds suspicious.
Yep. So
why is the bodyguard getting death threats?
Exactly. Exactly. So he gets arrested, obviously. And when the jury was presented with all the information, actually either 5 or 7, I found both. So I don't know which one is right on the jury who couldn't decide. Because obviously it has to be unanimous if this person is guilty. So the reasoning
you couldn't decide?
Right. There was no actual like DNA evidence, but hello, his DNA is all over the freaking house. He lived there. So obviously there's not going to be something that sticks out. And there was no like murder weapon found. So there was no actual concrete evidence. So these people were hung up. And what changes their mind? One of the jurors, while they were in there deliberating, picked up a photo of Chris and Tara and turned it over and saw it dated in October, which was 2 months before Tara had testified that their relationship started. So in their mind, they're like, she lied under oath. So what else are they lying about?
Did she get in trouble for perjury?
I don't think so.
What?
Not that I could find. So when the rest of the jurors saw that, the five or seven that couldn't agree, they gave him a guilty verdict. And the day that the guilty verdict was given, that was on the 2-year anniversary of the murders.
Oh, well, that's some poetic justice.
Exactly. So on the next day, the jury goes in with a decision to make whether or not to give Chris the death penalty, which at that point, I think they were all leaning towards the death penalty. But when they arrive, it is announced that Chris wants to waive his right to a jury sentencing. So the judge decides on a life sentence without the possibility of parole. And I think one of the jurors actually swayed his decision for this because she basically said that he should serve out the rest of his life thinking about what he did to his family, that he shouldn't get an easy way out.
That's true.
So he was incarcerated at the Pontiac Correctional Facility or Correctional Center, but he actually had to be transferred for security reasons to Wisconsin. I don't know the actual correctional facility that he was transferred to, but he is currently in Wisconsin. He still pleads his innocence, and his parents don't believe their son is capable of such a heinous crime either. Why would they? They're terrible.
Yep.
And in 2020, he actually petitioned for a new trial, but the judge dismissed it.
Good.
Thank goodness. Yep. And Chris Coleman has continued to be a religious man and currently preaches in prison to other inmates.
You know, the disgusting thing is that he probably has women that are like flocking to him in prison. They're writing him letters.
Oh, I'm sure he does, because I don't like saying this about people who murder people, but he wasn't a bad looking guy. Just like Chris Watts. Like there's this appeal to them, I guess. I don't know.
Well, women have done that with Scott Peterson. They're definitely doing it with Chris Watts, and I'm sure they did it with this guy. And for the life of me, I just sit here and I'm like, what are you actually doing, guys?
Right?
Like, murdered.
I mean, if you find Mr. Clean attractive, you'll find Miss Chris Coleman attractive.
Oh, he looks like Mr. Clean.
Right, he's bald. He had that, like, you know, tough bodyguard look, shaved head, and he currently there's some pictures where you're like, okay, yeah, he's not bad.
With the hair, he looks better.
Yeah, agreed.
What is that forehead, though? I don't even feel bad saying this. The guy's an asshole, and she was cute.
She's beautiful. Oh, she and their was kids cute. Were beautiful.
How do you kill those kids?
I don't know.
Prisoner's Exhibit 37. She needs to not wear purple eyeshadow. So Tara, if you're listening to this, stop wearing purple eyeshadow. And I hope that you're able to live with yourself.
Something else crazy is that, I know, because she's pretty much the reason that those people are, I mean, I don't want to place all the blame, because obviously.
He did it. He's a piece of shit. It. She played a part.
Right.
Why are you having an affair with a man and then planning a family with him? And I wouldn't be surprised if she had some kind of knowledge.
Yeah, I mean, he said to her that he was going to give Sherry divorce papers on the day that he killed them.
Oh, well, that is divorce.
Yeah.
You're not married to him anymore.
We actually call it widowed Chris.
Oh, and those claw marks. She was fighting.
Oh, I didn't even see those pictures.
Oh my gosh, I'm going to send them to you right now. Hold on.
Okay. And so something else is crazy is that his mom has been sending him like different books in prison. Most of them, they're like religious books that he can kind of use, I guess, for his preaching. And she sent like grief books to him, and he sent them right back. Because he's not grieving, obviously.
Obviously not. He's a psychopath if you're not grieving for your kids that you murdered.
Yeah.
Hey, you probably want to kill him in the first place.
He's just disgusting. So yeah, that was my heartbreaking case of Sherry Garrett and Gavin Coleman.
It's tragic.
Well, thank you guys for listening. We will see you guys next Monday for our two case a topic episode for Killer Kids. And we hope you guys have a good week.
Yeah. Have a great one, everyone. Thanks for listening.
Don't be dark and deadly. Okay. Bye.
Bye.